And it also would cast a terrible cloud over the U.S. Supreme Court as an institution.
Alaskans travel to D.C. to urge Senator Murkowski to vote no on Judge Kavanaugh. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, is Alaska on its way out of a recession?
In my mind, the recovery, or full recovery, would be when we actually get back the jobs that we've lost.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state from Valdez, Anchorage, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of three undecided Republicans who could sink Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination. Some of her constituents boarded last-minute flights to make their case to her in person. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin caught up with one group who made the long trip to urge Murkowski to vote no.
Sarah Cleafy of Anchorage says she and every sexual assault survivor she knows has churned with emotion since Christine Blasey Ford accused Kavanaugh of attempted rape, and he angrily denied it.
We had this, you know, unspoken understanding of, like, this week has been terrible. So when the opportunity came up to do something about it and come talk to Senator Murkowski, I didn't hesitate.
Cleafy heard that the American Civil Liberties Union would pay to fly more than 100 Alaska women to D.C. Barely a day after getting the okay, Cleafy boarded a red eye and was in Washington by morning.
Oh my God, it's so hot.
Wow, people, like,
suits.
Yeah, they're not wearing yoga pants only? What's happening?
Now she's sharing a hotel room with acquaintances. Anchorage attorney Nora Barlow and Lori Pickett and Krista Scully, both program administrators at separate Alaska nonprofits. The four women made their way to an outdoor cafe. Even a stranger at their communal table wished them well.
So you guys just overnight purchased your tickets, jumped on the plane.
Yes.
Well, that's commitment.
Yes,
that's
left our families.
I'm impressed.
A massive protest in the Hart Senate office building raged as some of the ACLU-sponsored Alaskans met with Murkowski in the afternoon.
How was it? It looks like it was emotional.
It was a very intense meeting.
Moira Smith is an Anchorage attorney and survivor of sexual harassment and assault. She says in her large group appointment with Murkowski, they told the senator elevating Kavanaugh would send a terrible message.
It would confirm that men's behavior like this, which has damaged so many people, can go unnoticed and unblemished, and that people can get away without a real mark. And it also would cast a terrible cloud over the U.S. Supreme Court as an institution.
A recent poll suggests a greater number of Alaskans want Murkowski to confirm. But the pro-Kavanaugh side is quieter and far less visible at the senator's office in Washington. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Most eligible Alaskans received their permanent fund dividend deposits today. Alaska residents have shared in the state's oil wealth for decades, eagerly anticipating the reveal of the annual check's amount and making plans on how to spend it. More recently, the excitement has been muted as Governor Bill Walker and state legislators have capped the payout in response to the state budget deficit. The legislature set this year's check at $1,600. The payout, by some estimates, would have been closer to $3,000 if not capped. Walker defends his decision to have the amount available for checks in 2016 when oil prices were low and lawmakers were gridlocked on addressing the deficit.
That adjustment that was necessary to save it is one that we could not have saved it without it.
Walker says the legislature eventually capped subsequent dividends, although there was certainly some disagreement. He says it has saved the program.
You know, to sit back and allow that to drain out in such a way that we had a couple high years and then it's down in the, you know, a couple hundred dollar range was the one that was unsustainable.
While some Alaskans have defended those decisions as politically courageous, others have cast Walker as a thief. The issue has been a factor in the race for governor. Both Republican Mike Dunleavy and Democrat Mark Begich have criticized the governor for vetoing half of the PFD in 2016. They say he should have followed the formula used until then, but neither has said exactly how they would pay for full dividends. Alaska's economy has been in recession for 3 years now. According to economists, exactly when the recession will end and what that turnaround will look like is still coming into focus. But as Alaska Public Media's Abby Collins reports, 2019 may be a turning point.
The Department of Labor and Workforce Development puts out a forecast each January on what the next year will bring. State economist Neil Fried says right now he does not know what that report will look like.
Will we predict that we're coming out of recession in 2019? I don't know that yet.
There are some good things happening in Alaska's economy. Job losses are slowing. Certain industries are doing well. And oil?
Oil was the cause for this recession, and things are looking good in the oil patch.
But are these improvements enough for the state's economy to recover? Fried says it's not that simple. The state has lost so much ground, between 12 and 13,000 jobs, that it's going to take a while to get back to where Alaska was in 2015. And even though job losses are letting up, they're still happening. Parts of the economy, like the retail sector, are struggling.
I think that there are signs that point that we are towards the tail end of the recession, but we haven't come out of it.
Musin Gatabi is an economist with the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research. He says Alaska is still in a recession, but expects the state will stop losing jobs in the next 6 to 8 months. And that would be a signal that the recession is ending.
End of recession is we're no longer bleeding jobs, we're no longer losing jobs, and we are turning the corner or at least finding a new normal. In my mind, the recovery or a full recovery would be when we actually get back the jobs that we've lost.
There is a really important word that's been mentioned a few times, recovery. Both Fried and Gatabi say there's a big distinction between when a recession ends and when the economy actually recovers. When the state stops losing jobs and economists are confident that it will stay that way, that marks the end of a recession. Fried says that would probably be determined after 2 quarters of straight growth. But there's no strict definition of a recession's end. Recovery, on the other hand, comes when job numbers are back to where they were at the start of the recession. Remember, the state lost between 12 and 13,000 jobs. That is a lot to make up. Here's Gatabi again.
I think that the recovery of jobs lost will be elusive. We've lost, depending on from which month you count, we've lost close to 13,000 jobs.
These economists say the economy on the other side of the recession probably won't be radically different. But they do point to one important change that's happened already. A big percentage of revenue paying for state government is now coming from permanent fund earnings.
Which is a very different place than oil revenues, straight oil revenues.
Gatabi says that should help the state's economy out in the future. He says while oil will still be a major player.
What we've done with the budgetary decisions is we've disentangled a portion of revenues from oil. And I think that that should make Alaska more resilient to future oil-driven recessions.
As for this recession, what it will take for the economy to get back to where it was in 2015 and when that will happen is still unclear. In Anchorage, I'm Abby Collins.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researchers receive a grant to study landslide prediction in Sitka.
And when you live between the mountains and the ocean, you always run the risk.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
Alaska state troopers have released the names of four men killed in a collision on the park's highway. Troopers say a van driven by Siva Viramachani passed a commercial vehicle in a no-passing zone south of Cantwell. The van crashed into a pickup truck. Viramachani and three passengers died in the collision. Troopers say a fifth person in the van was in critical condition at an Anchorage hospital. A two-year-old boy in the truck was flown also to an Anchorage hospital with serious injuries, and in the truck were 23-year-old Colin Koski and 21-year-old Felicia Koski, both of Fort Wainwright and both of whom also suffered injuries, troopers say. The U.S. Coast Guard says it has taken a number of members in Kodiak off-duty status as it investigates allegations of illicit drug activity. The Associated Press reports Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Raymond Reichel says the investigation has only been going on for a very short period of time and will continue for several weeks. Reichel says members from a variety of units are being investigated, but he declined to give the number of people involved or what prompted the investigation. Reichel says the allegations could deal with anything from drug possession to the wrongful use of prescription medication. It's up to U.S. District Court Judge H. Russell Holland to decide if a federal civil rights suit filed against the city of Fairbanks will proceed. Judge Holland heard attorneys argue yesterday in Fairbanks on a city motion to dismiss the suit filed by the Native men known as the Fairbanks Four. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
George Fries, Marvin Roberts, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent allege racial bias-driven police misconduct, including coercion of false confessions and fabrication of evidence, led to them being wrongfully convicted of murder. New evidence pointing to other suspects in the 1997 beating death of John Hartman resulted in a fall 2015 hearing and an agreement with the state under which the Fairbanks Four convictions were vacated. City Attorney Matt Singer says the agreement does not meet the standard required to sue for damages.
There's a United States Supreme Court case that requires that before somebody comes to federal court in this kind of lawsuit, a malicious prosecution lawsuit, they first have to show what's called a favorable termination in the criminal case. And to do that, you have to show that you were essentially that you're found innocent.
That's an issue in the Fairbanks 4 case because although the agreement vacated the men's convictions, it did not make any determination about actual guilt or innocence. New York-based civil rights attorney Anna Benvenuti Hoffman argued on behalf of the Fairbanks 4, contending the agreement with the state constitutes a positive determination and leverage for a civil suit.
Once someone's been exonerated, once they've been, the conviction's been vacated, you know, they don't have any further incidents that can vote, then that's when you can bring suit in federal court.
Judge Holland will decide which interpretation is right according to precedent. Another Fairbanks 4 attorney, Mike Kramer, calls the matter tricky.
There's many, many similar but not identical cases out there that both discuss the validity of these types of, you know, release dismissal agreements, as well as the, you know, what was discussed as a favorable termination rule. Very few cases that have ever involved this type of situation.
Kramer says he expects Judge Holland to issue a ruling on the city's motion to dismiss the case within a short time frame. Marvin Roberts, one of three of the Fairbanks Four who was in attendance at the oral arguments, expressed optimism following the proceeding.
We just hope for a positive outcome, and we just like to thank all of our supporters who got us here.
The Fairbanks Four are seeking damages from the city for 18 years they spent in prison. Under the 2015 agreement they signed with the state, the men agreed not to sue, but they say they signed the deal under duress. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The company that owns Raven Air Group was the top bidder for Penn Air's assets at an auction yesterday. The regional air carrier that primarily serves the Bristol Bay and the Aleutian Pribilof region has been undergoing bankruptcy proceedings since last summer. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
A federal judge ordered Penn Air to sell off its assets as a part of its bankruptcy proceedings. That auction was held Wednesday in Anchorage.
Michael Markham is the attorney for the trustee overseeing the sale.
We had two bidders. The prevailing bidder was J.F. Lehman & Company, who's the owner of Raven Air Group, and their bid was $12.3 million in cash, along with other considerations, some contract assumptions, including covering liabilities under the company health plan.
The buyer would also pick up the primary aircraft leases from Pinair. Peninsula Airways has been owned by the Siebert family for more than six decades. For many years, it was the primary and often only service between Anchorage and Bristol Bay. It is the only connection between Anchorage and Unalaska, as well as most of the Aleutian and Pribilof Island communities. It filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in August of 2017. The cash from the sale will be put toward paying the company's debts, but Markham said that it is unlikely all creditors will be paid.
The first debts that will get paid are the secured debts. Those will get paid first off the top, and then after that, the post-bankruptcy debts have a higher priority than the pre-bankruptcy debts. So the balance of the money will likely be exhausted paying post-bankruptcy debts, but we don't have a definite accounting of all of those. So I don't want to completely foreclose any chance of money making it to the pre-bankruptcy creditors, but it's likely that we'll get close to paying the post-bankruptcy creditors in full.
Markham estimated that Pinair owes a little more than $5 million in secured debts, between $6 million and $10 million in post-bankruptcy debt, and several million of pre-bankruptcy debt.
So there's definitely not enough money, you know, with the $12.3 million to go around.
Friday afternoon, the purchase will go before a bankruptcy judge in Anchorage.
That will hopefully result in the entry of an order approving the sale, and then the bidder will start their process of obtaining approvals with the FAA and DOT, and as soon as those approvals are obtained, which will hopefully take 4 to 6 weeks, there'll be a closing after those approvals are obtained.
This sale is not a merger. Markham stressed that Pinair will continue to operate under that name and separately from the current Raven operations. In the immediate future, he said he does not anticipate changes to service for Bristol Bay or the other communities Pinair serves. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Bethel residents voted to keep alcohol sales for the time being as the strictest form of local option that would have banned all legal sales failed in Tuesday's election. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports that many in the community are wondering what comes next.
Sponsors of the petition drive that put the proposition on the ballot are disappointed and now seek different options to move forward. One thing is for certain, legal sales are still going on in Bethel, though for now there is only a beer and wine store and a restaurant selling those beverages. While there is no one currently selling liquor legally anywhere in town, that could change quickly. The Alcoholic Beverage Control Board tabled a discussion and a vote on a transfer of Bethel Native Corporation's liquor license to the Sea Lion Corporation, which owns Swanson's. The ABC board will meet on the 15th of this month, and that transfer is likely to appear on the agenda. Should the transfer go through, there'd be nothing preventing Sea Lion from going beyond BNC's decision to voluntarily limit sales to beer and wine, and instead sell hard liquor. BNC decided on that limit voluntarily in the months following the denial of Alaska Commercial's liquor store license renewal and its subsequent closure. Cesar Michinski is the other liquor license holder in Bethel and currently has a one-year extension from the Bethel City Planning Commission for his plans to comply with parking lot requirements set in place for his proposed liquor store. His license was granted back in April, but his conditional use permit has been on hold, in part to await the outcome of this local option vote. How best to move forward is a question that's on everyone's minds, and the next steps are not yet clear. Changes can come either through another type of local option election or through city ordinance. But an ordinance like the one proposed this past June by Councilmember Leif Albertson to limit sales to beer and wine, essentially, might make the city legally vulnerable, says Bethel City Attorney Patty Burley.
Well, the ABC Board and Alaska statute has licenses that limit beer and wine. When you're wet, you open all of them, not just the beer and wine licenses. So we would be open to challenge by a regular liquor store saying, wait a minute, you're infringing on my right to sell what I'm legally allowed to sell.
That means the best path forward could come from another, less restrictive type of local option, such as Type 2, allowing import and possessions and restaurant sales, or local option Type 3, which would allow the city to run its own package store, such as the one Kotzebue currently operates. In Bethel, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
With only 74 of them left, the Pacific Northwest's endangered killer whales are getting a lot of attention. But orcas around the world are threatened by toxic chemicals called PCBs. Northwest News Network correspondent John Ryan explains.
The killer whales known as transients eat other mammals, like harbor seals. That puts them at the very top of the food chain, and it exposes them to even more of the PCBs that threaten their fish-eating cousins. The industrial chemicals were banned 40 years ago, but they linger in many places. Our region's transient orcas have 10 to 20 times more PCBs in their blubber than resident orcas do. The study in the journal Science says that puts the transients at high risk for a population collapse in coming decades. Transients in our part of the world are currently doing much better than the resident orcas. About 500 transient killer whales now swim in the Northeast Pacific. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan.
With the departure of the Westerdam and the Norwegian Pearl on Tuesday, Juno's 2018 cruise season has officially come to an end. The industry projected about 1.2 million passengers this year, compared to about 1.1 million last year. This summer also saw the arrival of the Alaska's first megaship, the Norwegian Bliss. Kirby Day, the port manager for Princess Cruises and the Holland America Group in Juneau, said final industry numbers and projections for next year will likely come in the next week or two.
We coped quite well with the situation and the growth this year. That's not to say it was perfect, but I think that looking forward toward next year and probably another 12 to 13% increase, we have to pay close attention to those impacts.
Cam Burns, who works as a tour guide in the summer, testified at a Juneau Assembly meeting in September that the local tourism industry is already strained under the increased number of visitors. He said bus fleets and road capacity are maxed out. Short stays are another complaint.
Between the crowds and the shorter stays, the complaints about Juneau as a stop are increasing. I hear them every day. The last thing we want for our city is our guests going home and complaining about the less than stellar experience they got here.
Burns also said the Bliss routinely left late due to the large number of passengers it had to load and unload each week. Day said things got easier as the season went on.
Everyone was a little bit concerned about 4,500 to 4,700 passengers moving on and off of a ship and that was only here from, say, I think 6 to 1:30. But most of the time, they were within, 15, 20 minutes of their departure, and it didn't throw their schedule off.
Next year, several more ships like the Bliss will arrive in Southeast Alaska. The Royal Princess, a Princess Cruises ship, will carry around 3,500 passengers, and the Royal Caribbean's Ovation of the Seas will have around 4,000. A research partnership has been awarded $2.1 million to study landslide prediction in Sitka. The three-year Smart and Connected Communities grant comes from the National Science Foundation with the goal of using relatively inexpensive sensor technology and existing social networks to create a real-time warning system in Sitka and other communities at risk of slides. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It's been just over 3 years since Sitka was struck by a cluster of three landslides, two of which were relatively harmless and the third fatal. Margie Esquiro's house is just below where the deadly Kramer Avenue slide turned and eventually came to a stop.
There was a knock on the door and someone yelling, Mrs. Esquiro, you have to leave, you have to leave. And so I quickly threw some clothes on, tried to call Pete, but I couldn't. And I jumped in the car and I went down to where he was. And as I was leaving, there were police in the neighborhood with loudspeakers. They were next door. I took nothing and left for a week.
Many people in Sitka remain on edge during heavy rains. One of the town's elementary schools was identified in a geotechnical mapping undertaken after August 18th as being in an area of moderate risk for landslides.
One of the motivations of the project is to ease nerves a little bit by providing a better sense of what the risks are.
Rob Lempert is a risk analyst with the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit based in Pittsburgh. As a co-principal investigator for the grant, he'll be pulling together a team from RAND, the Sitka Sound Science Center, the U.S. Forest Service, and other partners to approach the problem of landslide risk from a couple of different perspectives. The first is straight-up geoscience.
Using very low-cost networked sensors, which we're going to deploy in the hillsides, which will give a much better indication of soil moisture and therefore let us do a better job of landslide prediction, and then use new image classification technologies to get a better idea of the base landslide risk in the area.
Lempert has already been to Sitka. He and a RAND colleague, policy analyst Katie Wipke, traveled here under a planning grant in 2017 to speak to community leaders and to potential partners and to refine the full proposal. Prior to her work with RAND, Wipke served as an AmeriCorps volunteer at Mount Edgecombe High School. She understands Sitka and the layers of complexity in moving forward with this research.
Like, does it bring more expensive insurance or home prices or things like that? And I think that's one of the other things that we want to explore through the social science side is what's people's appetite to fully understand the risks.
That is the $2.1 million question. In clear weather, Sitkans look out across a sparkling bay to a dormant volcano. The mountains that form the town's majestic backdrop are frequently the source of tragedy. Margie Esquiro's husband, Pete, said plainly what many Sitkans already understand.
You know, when you live between the mountains and the ocean, you always run the risk of, if the ocean doesn't get you, maybe there's a possibility the mountains might get you. So, we all live in a risk situation.
And in truth, no amount of money or research can really reduce that risk. At best, says Rob Lempert, we may not totally tame the chaos, but our goal is to make significant strides. The official start date of the 3-year landslide prediction project in Sitka was October 1st. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Abby Collins in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, John Ryan in Seattle, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.